who want to get enlightened. Just tell me that the heart of the Dharma quickly and in Greek, because I'm a busy person. But anyway, so the Thai forest tradition, it was, I think there was always like a forest tradition in all countries, and it's always the fact that there will always be some people who go back to the original tradition, and they can read the books, and they know in their hearts know what the original Buddhism was all about, that the Buddha became enlightened under a tree, not in a sort of a city somewhere. And they know the Buddha was very frugal, just had his bowl and robes and hardly any possessions. And they know that there is something in our hearts which knows what austerity truly is. It's not really austerity. That seems to be like too harsh. It's more like simplicity, which I think is a much nicer word. Like a simple lifestyle. And so I think it was a long time ago, actually in the time of the Ayutthaya kingdom in Thailand, there used to be the two different types of Buddhism in Thailand at the time, was the city tradition and the forest tradition. It was not like two different sects, but they were administered separately. So the forest monks and the city monks were looked upon as being a little bit different, needing different needs, and were administered sort of separately. But after the fall of the Ayutthaya kingdom, then there was a lot of confusion in the kingdom while they got themselves together again. So there would have been forest monks still around all those years. But then it became like a couple of teachers, like Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Sao, which is like some of the leaders of the tradition from which we come from. They got their act together again and started wandering in the jungles and the forests, looking for teachers, looking for solitude, living very simply, and keeping the old rules of Vinaya very, very strictly. And they started, or rather not started, revived a tradition of, you might call it pure Buddhism, but if it is pure Buddhism, it must be impure Buddhism as well. Impure Buddhism is one of these oxymorons. It's either Buddhism or it's not Buddhism. It's either Dharma or it's not Dharma, really. And so that forest tradition has always been quite inspiring, especially amongst the people who have a bit of a feeling for what Buddhism should truly be. And these days, that when people are becoming more knowledgeable about spiritual things, that they want to turn away from just empty rituals. They want to turn away from like a priestcraft, where monks do these rituals just for money. And they just want to get to the heart of this, which is like a tradition of dana, of just giving for no reward. Like as people like give food to the monks, not expecting anything back, because the monks give dharma for the lay people, not expecting anything back. As we serve each other with this liberality, with this love, which asks for nothing back. And this is actually the old tradition. We feel that this is something which is very true and very real inside of us. And we want examples of people who live simply. So that Thai forest tradition has hit a chord with many people. Not really, it's not really Thai, it's just the forest tradition. The reason why I say forest is actually the word forest is not the right word. It's called like Aranya, which just means like a wilderness outside of the towns and the cities. There are places where few people go. And this is where the monks would hang out for the sake of solitude. So it doesn't need to be a tree in a forest monastery. Like a desert would be the same, Aranya. Just an empty, lonely place. Which is why when we first came to Perth, we tried to find a piece of forest about 1 hour from the city of Perth. Not too far, not too near. Close enough where people can come if they want to make the effort. But not too near that it's in the city and it becomes too crowded. That's why we got our monastery in Serpentine. So this is actually the tradition which we come from. Living outside of the cities, but not too far away. For the sake of solitude, for the sake of peace, for the sake of quietness. Unfortunately, what happens with the forest tradition, it's got its own seeds of destruction within it. Because once you have the forest monks, once they become inspiring and well known, then they become too well supported. When they become too well supported, they get slack, fat and lazy. When they become slack, fat and lazy, so what was once a good forest monastery becomes just too easy. And too many people go there because it becomes famous. And it becomes, this is quiet again. And so it has its own, it sees its own destruction, because the false tradition which seeks to escape from the world becomes sought after from the world. So in the old days, that when the false tradition first started, even like or when I first went over to places like Wat Pa Phong, not many lay people went there. So it was very, very poorly supported. And the food was disgusting, as I said many times. But at least we never got invited out to chanting. We never had to do that sort of stuff. So we had all this time to meditate. But it's become more and more popular. Instead of inviting the city monks to do all these chanting ceremonies, the lay people wanted the forest monks to do all these ceremonies. So we actually got even more busy than the city monks. So it's got its seeds of its own destruction in that sense. But then eventually, that when the forest monasteries, they become decadent, then there's always some monks who rebel and they go back to the original traditions and they start another monastery somewhere in great simplicity until they do become famous and the whole thing becomes decadent again. It's anicca, impermanence, is the way of things. So that's actually the way of our forest tradition. That makes sense?
Is it really tight, or is it really melt and merge with the Burmese, like is there a Burmese forest tradition as well?
There certainly is a Burmese forest tradition. That's why you never see those monks. There's some amazing monks. There's a few people who are in our society who are Burmese and who've gone back to Burma, and not into just Rangoon or Mandalay, but really out in the bush. And there's some amazing monks out there. Like, you know, real forest monks with all those psychic powers and stuff like that. There was one monk that, he was one of the fellows, many of you know him, Wayne. He's married to a Burmese girl, and his Burmese wife is always back in Burma somewhere, and he tags along. He has some wonderful stories about great Burmese monks. There's this one monk who became famous because he was levitating in front of a train, and the train driver decided to see how fast this monk could go. So the train driver put down his foot down, as it were, and the train went as fast as it possibly could. But the monk just kept up with it all the time. It was always, you know, a few meters ahead. It was just like monks playing around. So as a result of that, that monk became quite famous in this part of Burma. And this, you know, he met this monk. And this is what monks will do for a laugh sometimes. So there are still all those great stories and those great monks, but they're inaccessible usually. They go off into the bush, into the forest. And you all know that story, that's one of my favourite stories. There's a monk who could levitate in the forest until the king found him. And the king, you know, a lot of kings are like, they get really impressed with levitating monks. And so the king decided to invite this monk into the city, because the king said, all I'll ask from you is just once a week I'll just go to discuss Dhamma. It's really important, it's useful, because as a king, you know, I've got such responsibilities, what I do, how I conduct myself affects the happiness of so many people. So you know, you'll be doing great service to others if you can actually come and stay in my palace so that you can instruct me on right and wrong. It's a very, very strong argument. But the monk first said, look, I'm a forest monk, I like living in the forest. And the king said, don't worry, I can make a forest in my palace grounds. And that's not just an odd thing, because I once went into Chitlada Palace, that's where the King of Thailand lives. And he built a forest in his compound, where there was a monk, Ajahn Lien, Ngpu Lien, was staying in there. Because he came to Perth and I got to know him, so he invited me to lunch there. So it's right next to the palace. And so the King of Thailand did this because he wanted to actually to retire, to abdicate and live the rest of his life sort of as a monk in this little hermitage which he built himself in the palace grounds. But things didn't work out that way. So that you can actually do that, sort of make a little forest in the middle of the city. And this is what that king did. And he invited this monk in to actually to just instruct him on the Dhamma. And the monk said, well, you know, living in a forest, in a real forest, or living in a forest in the city, it's the same thing, isn't it? It doesn't really matter. So he went and stayed in there, in the city. And every morning he would go for his morning exercise, up in the air, flying around. And everything went really well, until one day the king was busy, and so the king didn't bring the lunch that day. Instead, he sent one of his princesses, one of his daughters, who was extremely beautiful. And as this monk was coming in to land, he saw this beautiful princess, and he had one moment of lust. And that's all it takes to lose your psychic powers. And so he came crashing down to the ground because he lost his ability to fly. And he realizes the dangers of living in the city. And he had to walk back to his forest, and it took many years to get his psychic powers back again. So that's another reason why monks stay in the forest. It's an old Buddhist story. It's a nice one. That's actually why be very careful if you learn how to levitate. Make sure you don't forget halfway up. Okay, now this is just not a question but a nice statement. Thank you, Adam, for showing us how the Dharma works in so many beautiful ways. Very kind of you. Next question. When Ajahn Chah was teaching retreat in America, a lay meditator asked Ajahn Chah what he does when he meditates. And Ajahn Chah said, "I just keep the mind where it already is." What do you think Ajahn Chah meant by this? Also, I have heard that when Ajahn Chah meditated, he could enter jhana on the in-breath even before the first exhalation. How do Arahant's abilities vary with respect to samadhi and wisdom? Have you heard if Ajahn Chah could still enter jhana so easily during his illness, during the last years of his life? And do you have any helpful advice on practicing samadhi when in deep pain? You're supposed to have only one question each. This is like a whole exam paper. Riverfied. Okay, when Ajahn Chah teaches retreat in America, said, "I just keep in mind where it already is." Ajahn Chah is just beautiful the way he sort of put things. So, now, where are you? In a present moment, silence, right in the middle of things, right in the center of things. That's where you put your mind, where it is. Stupid, isn't it? How can you put your mind anywhere else other than where it is? But that's what we do. We put our mind in Singapore when it's in Perth. We put our mind sort of in the future when it's in the present. We put our mind in the past when it's in the present. And we put our mind into jhana when it's not into jhana, it's just wandering around. Now, wouldn't it be wonderful if you put your mind, if the mind is wandering around, you put your mind into the wandering. What happened then? It means it's called contentment, letting go, being still, being at peace. Being where you are, instead of trying to be somewhere else. It's the end of craving. Putting your mind where it already is. No desire. Contentment. Freedom. Ajahn Chah was beautiful when he said things like that. He knew exactly what he meant. And that's actually how one becomes still. So if you keep the mind where it already is, that's a nice little mantra for you for the rest of the retreat. Keep your mind where it already is. And then you go all the way to jhanas and everywhere else. It's lovely. Also, I've heard that when Ajahn Chah meditated, he entered jhana on the in-breath even before the first exhalation. How do you know that? I know Ajahn Chah never said that, but you get all these rumours come along about sort of my teacher's better than your teacher. Your teacher took one whole in-breath and out-breath. My teacher. It doesn't really matter, does it? Just wouldn't you be happy if we just like three exhalations or whatever? Anyway, how do arahants' abilities vary with respect to samadhi and wisdom? Okay, it's like some arahants, especially with wisdom. All arahants have got great samadhi and great wisdom, but some arahants can teach it and some can't. And that's actually the difference there, the main difference. So there are some just amazing monks who are just so peaceful, but they just haven't got the ability to put it into words, they can't teach. There's some arahats, and that was actually one of Ajahn Chah's great gifts. Not only was he enlightened, but he could actually really teach in so many beautiful ways. He had that rare gift to be able to do that. Have you heard if Ajahn Chah could stay in the jhana so easily during his illness during the last years of his life? Yeah, I mean, you've heard that story before of one of the monks who was looking after him, and when Ajahn Chah stopped breathing while he was ill. You haven't heard that story? Yeah. No. Shall I tell it? desire. Okay. One of the monks you know very well. Perhaps I won't tell his name, but he's very well known to you. you may know him, because even though he's now the abbot of this big monastery. He's just turned his leg. But he was actually looking after Ajahn Chah. He was doing that in the nursing job when Ajahn Chah was very, very ill, couldn't speak. And as it happened quite a few times, Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. Now, that because of his illness, it's actually interesting that when he really got ill, all the monks had this big meeting together. I was here in Australia at the time, and Ajahn Jagra as well. So the monks inside had a meeting. They discussed what should they do. Should they try and look after Ajahn Chah, who's in a coma, couldn't speak, or should they just let him die? So they decided, just let him die. Just, no, don't try to look after him, because just let nature take its course. And about a day or two later, you got a message from the king of Thailand. No way, you look after that monk. So they had to look after him. And the king of Thailand arranged and paid for a nurse to be with Ajahn Chah 24 hours on roster. There was always a nurse in the local hospital who was actually in the monastery Wat Pa Phong looking after Ajahn Chah, and about three, maybe four monks there as well. They're all on roster, sometimes on night shift, day shift, afternoon shift, or whatever. So it happened quite a lot on these times that Ajahn Chah would just stop breathing for long periods of time. And when he did this work when Ajahn Yana was there, oops, I've mentioned his name. Never mind. The Ajahn Chah stopped breathing again. And of course, as soon as the nurse saw this, the male nurse got very afraid. Because, you know, if you stop breathing for too long, you die. And even though the nurse knew that one day Ajahn Chah must die, he didn't want Ajahn Chah to die on his shift. On somebody else's shift, it was okay. You know what we like. So he wanted to revive him, do things, and all the monks said, "Look, leave him alone. He's just entering into a deep samadhi, into jhana." And so the nurse didn't believe this. You know what some of the medics are like, scientists are like, they don't think he's in good shape. So the medic on this occasion, they made this compromise. They decided that, okay, we'll just take Ajahn Chah's, take blood samples every few minutes, just to make sure the blood is well oxygenated. Because the only reason why not breathing is a danger is if there's not enough oxygen in the blood to go to the brain. That's just simple medicine. So every few minutes or whatever, this nurse took a blood sample just to check the oxygen level in the blood. About 3 or 4 hours, when Ajahn Chah stopped breathing, and they found out the oxygen level was constant throughout that period. And because there's always oxygen in the blood, the nurse was actually quite happy just to let Ajahn Chah just stay like that, not breathing. And then started feeding again. This was normal. So it's interesting, sort of one of these wonderful experiences, usually when people are sick or something, where doctors or nurses are around and they find out actually what happens when you're in a deep samadhi state. Here, there's no breath going in and out at all, but the oxygen level was always the same. So there's no problem with brain damage or any other organ damage. So that was actually a direct experience of seeing Ajahn Chah. Even though I was in coma, couldn't say anything, couldn't do anything, every now and again we'll just go into deep jhanas. According to the sutras, they say that's fourth jhana when you stop breathing. And do you have any helpful advice on practicing samadhi when in deep pain? Okay, it's one of my stories which I tell all the time. When I was a young monk in Thailand, being a senior monk now, you sit in the front of cars, sometimes nice cars. But when you're a young monk, you sit in the back. Sometimes they have the cars like utes in Thailand, like, you know, pickup trucks. And you have to sit in the back. And because it rains and it's dusty, they have this metal, scaffolding or whatever you call it, around the back over which is stretched a tarpaulin to keep the rain off. And the road in Thailand in those days, it was very rare actually to find a sealed road in that part of Thailand. They're all dirt roads. And because of the heavy monsoon rains, they're always potholed. And you go in the back of these cars, just like in the pickup, the ute part in the back, where the dogs in Australia usually sort of, you know, get caught. That's where the monks went. And you go from these monasteries to monasteries. And whenever you hit a pothole, When the car went down, you went up. And you smashed your head on these iron rails again and again and again. And because you were a monk, you had no protection on top of your head, no padding. It's not like you people who've got all this hair, could cushion the blows. And what happened? Every time I hit my head, being only a young monk, maybe 1 year from England, or maybe less than that, you'd swear. Because that's what you do, sort of, in the West, when you hurt yourself. You know, you say sort of a rude word. And it didn't matter, because I was the only Westerner in that car, so the cars couldn't understand me. I thought maybe they would. But whenever you hit a really deep pothole, when the tyres hit their heads, and they really cracked it very hard, they would laugh. And I couldn't understand what was going on. How can you laugh when you crack your head and hurt yourself that much? My first thought was perhaps they cracked their head so many times they were crazy. But then, being a scientist, from a scientific background, I decided to do an experiment. This is investigation, this is how insight works. I decided the next time we go down one of those potholes and I hit my head, I'll try laughing to see what happens. So when that happened, I went in a pothole, hit my head, crack. Instead of swearing, I laughed with the ties. And you know what you discover? That when you laugh in pain, it hurts much less. And if you don't believe me, get the person sitting next to you to hear you over the head. If you laugh, it does hurt less. So this is actually what we do with pain. Laugh. At least smile, if you can't laugh. And that don't be like a gritting your teeth smile. What you're doing is actually allowing it to be. Being kind to it, loving kindness, smiling at it, laughing at it, being at peace with it. Not trying to get rid of it. Certainly don't swear at it in your mind. Because that's what we do sometimes. It's moving pain. I come here on this retreat and this is what happens to me. Why does it always happen to me? I'm just about to get into deep meditation and then it gets this pain. Don't sort of get angry at it because it makes it hurt more. Laugh at it, smile at it. And then the pain is hardly there at all. The same as if you're having a terrible meditation retreat or a terrible day. Or just meditation, this one meditation you're doing now, just really hopeless. If you get angry and swear at it, it gets worse. If you just laugh at it, smile at it, be happy about it, then it disappears and it's a good meditation. Understand? Next question. Ajo, I think I won't make to Nibbana this life. Why not? Uh-oh, can I follow you instead, or maybe you put me in your bag? I don't like carrying things around. I'm trying to get rid of it. Not carrying things around. No, anyway. In Nepal and Burma, many children are subjected to monastic life without a choice. What are your views? Does this help them or possibly confine them to a life which they would know no other, thus making monkhood a living rather than a chosen livelihood? Your wisdom on this issue is appreciated. Okay, it happens in Thailand as well, Nepal and Burma and other places where young people, they become novices. And sometimes the reason is because there's some tragedy in their life. Maybe their mother is killed, or they're an orphan. Or sometimes it's because they have too many children and the family can't look after them all. So they send them to monastery to be looked after. And usually what happens, especially in Thailand, I think also in Burma as well, Sri Lanka, but if you're a little novice like that, you get looked after, you get sort of a decent upbringing, then you get schooled, you get sent to the school, and so you get an education, looked after, and usually what happens when they get about 15 or 16, they disrobe and leave and just go and join the world. So it's just like a little orphanage, and it's usually a very sort of pleasant orphanage, so the novices, they have a lot of fun, but they also, you know, learn a little bit of meditation, a little bit of Dhamma, and keeping precepts, and the monks are usually very, very kind to them. So every now and again, I remember in our monastery in Thailand, we always used to have one or two little novices, and some of them became really nice monks. don't know if you remember Tan Preacher who came here some years ago, Tan Mao, because he was a little novice years ago in Thailand with Ajahn Chah. He became a lovely monk. So yeah, I mean, sometimes that happens. It's just as part of social service, I suppose, of Buddhism in those countries. The monastery also becomes like an orphanage and also an old person's home as well. So sometimes people, you know, they become monks in their old age or nuns in their old age and get looked after, hang around the monastery, maybe not to become enlightened, but it's a nice way of going out of this life as a monk or a nun. So that's one thing they can do. So they might not have a choice at that age, but they have a choice later on, and they can always leave. Well, the nice thing about Buddhist Theravada monasticism is that, you know, if you, sometime it comes along, you don't not enjoy what you're doing, and it really is that, you know, not enjoying it, it's not just a whim, then you're allowed to leave. You can come back again afterwards if you wish, or you can just leave. And there's no real stigma about it, you know, because, you know, if it's, you've tried your very best, you've done your very best, sometimes the defilements catch you. And one of the people we know in Melbourne, he was a monk, there's some great monks in Burma, there's Thongpu Sayadaw and Pathok Sayadaw. And he came back to, this is like an interesting story, how to look after your monks, please do. Because he went back and stayed in Melbourne for a while, and there was actually an Indonesian girl who was very, very wealthy, who took a fancy for him, and just was like a challenge. Started chatting him up, and sort of he started breaking a few of his smaller rules about, you know, being alone with women. And just being very, very wealthy, you know, she said, well, if you, you know, leave the monk, couldn't stay with me, and I won't have to work because, you know, my father's very, very rich. And he thought that might be a good idea, and so he just wrote. And he said he went off with her to a hotel for one night, and after one night, he thought that he was in love with her and they were going to get married. And he just said, bye bye. I just after one night. And the poor monk had lost his monkhood. He went back to the temple. And it was very, this is what we really admire about him. He said, look, I'm sorry I just wrote, it's just lust. But my defilements came up. He was so honest about it. And because of that, everyone respected him. So sometimes that happens. You can always become a monk again, if you really want to. So when you do things like that, you know, you just wrote properly before, you know, you went to the hotel. So when you do things like that, sometimes that's, you know, monks or nuns, sometimes they're their weaknesses. And then you look at them afterwards and say, well, you know, sort of, you're human beings as well. So, you know, you learned a lesson. There's a lesson there, this little monk. So, yeah, sometimes as a monk, you know, you can leave, you can come back again, you can leave again, come back again. In Theravada Buddhism, we have this tradition, you can disrobe six times, and ordain seven times. And if you disrobe again, then that's it, you can't ordain again. Had enough. You can't make up your mind after seven times, that's it. So you do have that choice in that sense. And it's actually very, very good you have that choice, because one of the worst things in any tradition, if somebody makes a decision years and years ago, and they're not happy in monastic life, and there's no way out, they're stuck, they have to sort of live a life which they don't like, which is like a lie to them, and they can't really put their heart in it. Which means, you know, you have many bad monks, many bad nuns, and don't really want to be monks, don't really want to be nuns. So it's good to have the opportunity to disrobe, if you're not really happy where you are. But, if you're doing the job, and practicing, then it always leaves a lot of happiness and contentment. Yeah? Oh yeah, I mean, she was just playing around. It was like a challenge for her. She was being very, very selfish and indulgent. That was very, very bad karma for her. It was just like a challenge, you know, just something to do. See if I can sort of get this monk out of the lodge. Yeah? There's monk fault as well. I mean, it wasn't just her fault. Oh yeah. Yes, certainly, yeah. Some people do that. Sometimes the next time they sort of put a bit more effort in, or they go back and realise that, you know, the grass is greener on the other side, and think, maybe I can practice easier when I'm a lay person or whatever, and they think, no, let's go back and become a monk. The next time they maybe last longer. Yes, Jenny? Well, even that for monks, it's not actually a rule of vineyard, it's just a custom. So I'm sure it'd be the same for nuns as well. Okay, let's do another question here. Does the asawa of doing have as its cause or condition the asawa of being? What is the cause and condition for the asawa of being, and how is it extinguished? Okay, these asawas are the outflowings. And you've got the outflowing. What causes these outflowings? They say there's three asawas. There's the kama asawa, which is basically sensory desire, which is most of our doing. And there's bhava asawa, of being. We go out just to assert our existence. And avijja asawa, which is our stupidity. And you can actually see that out of sense of pleasure, wanting comfort, wanting to enjoy the world, you can see how that takes you out from inside. But also, this could be takes you out. Because when you get very, very, very still, the sense you're not being anything. You're not existing. Almost like exist is literally ex, which means to go, and is like to go, or to be out, means going out. But if you stay at home as if nothing is happening, nothing is moving, you're not being. And so there is that sense of that we, even if it's not just sensory desire, we do things as an assertion of our ego, of our self, because that's what a self does. It does things. It exerts. It goes out into the world to explore, to be, to say, "Look at me." And so that is actually the cause and condition of the asawa of being. This is just what a sense of self actually does. It wants to go out. The cause and condition of the asawa of being, how is it extinguished? Again, when you see that there's no one in there, then there's no reason to go out anywhere. There's no reason to actually assert that you are. And you can see that I've already mentioned a few times about the talks on non-self about will and knowing, not being you. And just how scary that is. And because of fear, we go out to actually assert ourselves to be. Sometimes people stay at home, they say they have low self-esteem. They don't go out into the world and meet friends and to do things and be things. But really what we're actually saying there, actually you're lessening the sense of ego and self and being. One of the lovely things when you go into deep meditation, that you feel you're not there anymore. It's the ending of being. An ending of asserting. An ending of measuring. And that's what one last thing is about, some of the deep jhanas. There's a sense of not being anymore. When you are, you feel you have to do something. And to be still, seems to be the antithesis of one another. If you're still, it's like you're dying. When you're active, you're being. So understand how that is an asawa, it takes you out of the world, makes you move. Sometimes we get afraid of dying, therefore we go out and do things. Sometimes the breath disappears, we think we're going to finish and we're ending. That's why you disturb it, go and do something. So a lot of time it takes the courage just to allow yourself to die in order to get very, very still. The jhanas of the dying of the ego. Temporary. Make sense?
Three or four, sort
of. Yeah, three. Third one is avijja, ignorance, delusion.
So going fancy.
Well, it's just basically general, just out of stupidity. Thinking happiness lies over there. It doesn't lie inside. Thinking in order to get fulfillment, to get happiness, to get peace, to get jhana, we've got to go out there and do it. Rather than realizing all we need to do is to stop and those things come to us. Okay, next question, it's a very deep one. Next question, dear Ajahn Brahm, please explain the importance of development of the 10 paramita qualities while doing meditation. There are, somebody's been looking these up. Generosity, that's dana. Virtue, that's sila. Renunciation, nekama. Wisdom, which is panya. Loving kindness, metta. Effort, vivya, determination, that's one I actually forgot this morning, adhidhana, truth, satya, equanimity, upeka, and kanti, which is endurance. What's the importance of those things? They know what generosity is. You give yourself to the meditation, not expecting anything back in return. You're just doing meditation for the sake of doing it. Not to get jhana, not to get enlightened. Just give. I'm going to give my energy, my mind, my time to this moment. I'm going to give it to the breath. It's full giving to the breath. Here you are, breath. You take over. Virtue is your sila, your goodness, the beauty of your heart. Renunciation, again, it's just giving up all possessions. I don't own my body, I don't own my mind. I don't own my little meditation place in this why not making a deal with the person sitting next to you to swap positions tomorrow? So it makes you much more mindful. Do any of you much want to swap positions so you could have talked more? I think they saw that one coming. And like wisdom is actually an understanding is how to meditate. If you're really wise, it's so easy to meditate because you know what to do. So often it's like meditation is just feeling one's way through a darkened corridor. When you're wise, you turn off all the lights, you see exactly where to go. You know where the light switches are, you know which way to go, and that's you can go into jhana easy. Loving kindness, again, the door of my heart's open to everything, no matter what happens in my meditation. So you're at peace with whatever happens. And so this is that love, which is freedom. And good effort, right effort, it's actually, you've got the right effort, because it's effort, but the right effort which goes in the right places. Which you're not into doing and controlling, it's not getting lots of will and force, because there are people with much greater willpower than you've got. They don't get enlightened. Because even though they've got great strength and vigour, they're put in the wrong places. Sometimes I've seen like these athletes, the amount of time they train, as you know, to compete at a high level, the amount of pain they go through to be able to sort of perform. If they put that type of effort in the right place in meditation, they'd be so enlightened. But they're putting it in the wrong place, into doing, into being, into winning, rather than just into knowing. So effort is good effort if it's put in the right places. If it's applied skillfully. Determination, adhidhana, those are little aspirations. You can make those little aspirations at the beginning of meditation, tell the taxi driver where you want to go, but then shut up. So don't confuse the determinations or aspirations. Sometimes I was telling some people in a meditation, if you get sort of a little bit lost, you don't know what to do next, you can just tell the mind just three words, just calm, calm, calm. It's almost like a determination, steering the mind into deeper states. Just say those words, calm, calm, calm. It's amazing, just the mind just goes a bit deeper into stillness. The mind is wandering all over the place, calm, calm, calm. It tends to stop. You know, if you're just watching the breath and it's not developing deeper, just calm, calm, calm. That's like an aspiration, a determination. Give the mind a little bit more direction, but not too much. And truth, satya, is that being honest. And that satya, being honest to what's really going on. So it's almost like part of mindfulness, to being fully aware of what's happening. Truthful to what's happening. So you're not trying to bend the truth to fit what you want to happen. It's very easy it is to make nimittas appear. This is an imitator, isn't it? It must be an imitator. I was visiting Ajahn Tate, this very great monk in the northeast of Thailand, and there was a lady, a Malaysian lady, who'd been staying with him for a long time. And she was having an interview, and I was just sitting in the back there, and she was telling about her meditation experiences. She said she went so still, nothing was happening. She said, it's fourth jhana, isn't it, Ajahn? And the Ajahn said, no, it's not fourth jhana. So she talked a little bit around and said, this is what happens, fourth jhana, isn't it? She said, no, there's not fourth jhana. And then she spoke again, and then she described the experience again, it's fourth jhana, isn't it? She said, no. And then she said again, it's fourth jhana, isn't it? Ah, it was fourth jhana. And she stopped speaking then, because that little grunt, which now sounded to me like, get out of here, you silly woman. That's what sounded to me like, to me. But to her, he grunted. He never said no, he grunted. So that was the confirmation she had four jhana from the great Ajahn Tate. She went around afterwards saying Ajahn Tate had confirmed she had four jhana. Sometimes we want it so much that when we hear, that during a meditation, the Ajahn Brahm smiled at you. That's confirmation. This is what happens sometimes. We want it so much that we sort of bend the truth. That's not satya. And equanimity is just looking on at this whole process of meditation retreat, not sort of wanting anything out of it. It's very close to love, just leaving things alone. And Kanti is just bearing with, knowing you're on the bus, just waiting, bearing with these things. There comes bad meditations and there's good meditations. And if we want the bad meditations to go quickly and the good meditations to come soon, the best way is just patience. Be very, very patient. But I've told you at the beginning of this retreat, the check is in the mail. You know what day is tomorrow?
Payday.
Friday, yes. Friday is payday. So be patient. Tomorrow's payday. So that's how you do the Paramita qualities. When you build those up in your life, you become very, very skillful people. Now don't just help in meditation, it helps with everything you do in life. Yeah?
The 10 Paramitas, is middle way, with all the middle way, wisdom or not in that time?
Basically, the Paramitas, I think they came after the death of the Buddha. They weren't there at the beginning, even though that those qualities are all praised by the Buddha. And in Mahayana, I think they started the Paramitas, they had 6 Paramitas. You know what it is like keeping up with the Joneses and doing one better. So the Theravada got 10 Paramitas. There we go, 4 more than you've got. And that's what it really was. But even so, it's still very useful. One of the nice things about the Paramitas is that the Mahayana Paramitas, they've got Dana, Virya, and I think it's Kanti, and they've got Sila Samadhi Panya. That's those 6 Paramitas in Mahayana. And they've often pointed out that any path which has got Sila Samadhi Panya is a path which has got the Eightfold Path. And the Buddha says specifically, it's in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, you can quote it, that wherever there is the Eightfold Path with the Sila Samadhi Panya, you'll find streamers, Vajratanas, Namratanas, Arahats. So what exactly is saying there? The Mahayana is a bona fide path to streamers, Vajratanas, Namratanas, and Arahats. No difference in Theravada. There's enough path of teaching there. If you practice your path, it doesn't matter what you call it, it leads to Arahats. Make sense? Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn, I have read of a different experience of meditation in the book entitled Forest Dark by Ajahn Mahabua. It is all in there. Thanking you very sincerely and most gratefully, yours in the Dharma. It's all in there. Yes, that's very true. But not in the book. In your heart. That's where it all is. Because books are just words, and sometimes we can read those books and not really understand actually what those words mean. Especially when they're in translations. Because sometimes those translations, I know this because many of Ajahn Chah's books have been translated into English, and sometimes you listen to the Thai, and then you read the English, and is that the same talk? Because the translator always puts so much of themselves into what they translate. Sometimes they even actually, unfortunately some of the Western monks have done this, and it's not actually good karma. They've actually not actually translated what's there, but they translate what they thought Ajahn Chah wanted to say. In other words, what they understand. So it's very, very difficult actually, and when I've done any translation, it's very, very difficult actually to translate it honestly, because you have to really check yourself and make sure at every sentence that you're not adding, you know, what you want to put in there, your understanding of Dharma. You have to put exactly what Ajahn Chah said or what Ajahn Mahabua says. That's very, very difficult to do sometimes. But the experience of meditation, you always find that in your own heart, not in any books. The books are the menus, the books are the signposts. And a menu is not the food, the signpost is not the destination. And signposts, for those who never realise the destination, the signposts can seem to be pointing in different directions. That's because they're placed in different situations. So if the signpost is to the east of the destination, it points west. If the signpost is to the west of the destination, it points east. So which is the right signpost? Which is the wrong one? Obviously they're both right, correct, because they're pointing to the same thing from different aspects. This is one of the problems where we argue about who's right and who's wrong. And you know that story, that sad story about the two monks arguing whether it's the flag moved or the wind moved? And they went to the master and said they saw this flag fluttering in the wind. And one said the flag moved, the other one said no, the wind moved. The Zen master said no, you're both wrong, the mind moved. And then they went to the Theravada master, and the Theravada master said, you're all three missed the point. Your mouths moved.
Who was the Theravada master?
Your mouths moved.
Yeah, who was the Theravada master?
I'm not saying. Yeah, that's my story. Many city monks hardly meditate, handle money, even eat afternoon. Are they still really monks? While they still serve the Dhamma, but they are also misleading the people about the path, a monk in Burma claims he has made a bodhisattva vow to be a Buddha in the third universe. Is this possible? Your comment, please. That's really weird. What do you mean a third universe? It's uncountable. Anyway, many city monks hardly meditate, handle money in the afternoon. You can only criticize other people if you don't do those things yourself. So, do you hardly meditate? Are you keeping all your lay precepts? What are you up to when you leave the retreat and go home? So sometimes we think maybe it's best not to criticize other people until we really do our practice. And we realize what we're up to. That's why Ajahn Chah used to tell us, monks, he said, at the very, 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 very most, you look at other people 5% of the time, you look at yourself 95% of the time. It's too easy to criticize others. And sometimes you criticize others and you don't really know whether what you're criticizing is true or not. Even the forest monks made mistakes. There was this young monk, I don't know if he was a novice, but or just a very young monk. He came to Wat Pa Pong monk, Wat Pa Pong, Ajahn Chah's monastery. He was a city monk from the north of Thailand. And he came there in his bright orange robes. And you see the forest monks wear these dark brown robes. And the city monks wear the bright orange ones. And he went there and they said, okay, you can go sleep in the hall. Usually the case was you can go and stay there for 3 days. And he just stayed there and no one paid him any notice at all. He'd actually come all that way to ask some questions on meditation, but no one paid him any attention. So after 3 days he left. And I think it was actually another top story. He met him in Chiang Mai. And that monk had, third jhana. He was a great meditator. He wanted actually to get some more help and advice. But the monks in Ajahn Chah's monastery had judged him as a city monk, as someone who doesn't keep the rules, someone who doesn't meditate, someone who probably eats afternoon, but he wasn't. He was a really, really good monk. Probably much better meditation than many of those monks in Wat Pa Pong. It's too easy to judge. So be very, very careful, just because you see that some monks live in the city and some monks live in the forest. Some monks belong to a good monastery, some monks to a bad monastery. Don't judge them by their monastery, by their robes. But there's much more depth to a monk than that. Same with a nun as well. You don't judge them because they're a woman or they're a man, because they wear white or they wear brown. It's very hard to measure a monk. There's one of the great forest monks. He was living in this, it wasn't really a forest, it used to be a forest monastery, but it's more like a sort of a village monastery. And the whole village would give him alms every day, But they thought it was just one of these old sort of lazy monks. And they never really knew he was one of the great arahats in Thailand. No, it was the last years of his life that sort of the word got around what this great monk was. I had the good fortune to go and visit him twice. He was a very great monk. And he was just unknown. People didn't realise what a great monk that was. He didn't really make so too much of his attainments. He was just humble. He was living almost alone. And it's only when he got very, very old, the other monks actually found him and realised who he was and made sure he was well looked after in the last years of his life. Be very careful not to criticise others. Sometimes we just don't know. Make sense? Mm. He was actually, I'll tell you a story about this monk. He was, this is one of Ajahn's stories. He was actually given a foot massage one night. And that's actually why he gives monks foot massages, because they get them sort of so soft and they sort of let out all their secrets. And if they don't, they press really hard until they do. No, they don't do that, otherwise you get to become. And he was just telling, you know, just chatting about all sorts of things, and where you come from, Australia, where's that down south, is it cold down there? And I think Adyanyana said something like, it's not cold in Australia, but if you go further south, there's this big place called Antarctica, which is really cold. And this man said, well, Antarctica, what's that? And he described all this ice and stuff like that, just further south in Australia. And he just, I thought he was just chatting about all sorts of things. You know, this is a Thai monk, never gone outside the northeast of Thailand, let alone got out of the country. And the following morning, sort of, this monk went up to Ajahn Yan and said, you know, you're right. It's just a lot of ice and a lot of snow down there. Really cold down there. He just got to check it out. Can you explain how to trace feelings back to their source? Once I'd been meditating peacefully at the monastery for a few days, when I was overcome by feelings of anxiety, my neck and back stiffened, I felt fearful. There was no apparent reason for this, it took a long time to go away. How should I have used this experience? Okay. It's, again, anxiety, neck and back stiffened, I felt fearful. Sometimes, actually, we create those pains in our body, mostly through fear, anxiety, we build them up. And we get into this like vicious cycle. Once we get a bit of pain from anxiety, that makes us anxious of the pain, and that makes the pain worse, we get even more anxious. We sort of tense up around the pain. One of the things which I've been teaching people, practice myself, if I get any sort of pain in the body, sometimes you feel it's like a ball of pain. It's this hard lump of pain somewhere. And usually what you do is actually tense up around it. And it means like there's whole layers of tension and inflammation around the source of that pain. So what I've done is actually tried to imagine that pain expanding, not trying to get rid of it, but actually spreading it through my whole body, going in the opposite direction again. Usually what I try to sort of contract it and squash it away. But I expand it and allow it to fill the whole body. When I allow it to expand and sort of really open out to it, when it expands, it like gets diluted. It's not so hard anymore, it's more soft. And I just carry on expanding outside my body until it becomes like a cloud, huge, but very thin. And I keep on expanding it until it gets so thin it's not there anymore. So it just vaporizes away. So a different way of like imagining pain. And sometimes what it's doing is going against the idea of anxiety. Anxiety wants to push it away. The opposite of that is just expanding and allow it to be. And it just be so much it fills the whole universe and it's so dilute you can't feel it anymore. So sometimes when these feelings come, sometimes that you can actually, it's very hard maybe to trace those feelings, find out what you were doing, what you were thinking. If you're very mindful, then you can actually trace that back, and if sometimes it's a stupid thought, it's there to be very anxious, what people are thinking of me. It's so many days into this retreat, I haven't got anywhere yet. Am I going to go home afterwards? My friends are going to ask me, what have you done? Spent all this money? Where you got jhanas? No, I didn't know. Stupid thoughts like that make me really anxious. So that's the only thing I can actually say. Tracing things back to the source. Okay. Oh, good. How come right livelihood is a factor of the path and is prostitution wrong livelihood? Interesting question. Because in the time of the Buddha there were many prostitutes, like there always have been, and actually they were respected in the community. And one of them was called Ambapali, and she became a great nun, a great arahant. She actually gave her park to the Buddha. It became one of the great places around Waisali where the Buddha lived. And have this story that Ambapali, when the Buddha came to Waisali and stayed in the great wood, Ambapali came there and invited him for a meal the following day. Just because she was a prostitute, didn't really matter, the Buddha said, yes, certainly. And then all of the other rich people came, and they just came a bit afterwards and said, can you come to the dharma tomorrow? I said, sorry, I've already received an invitation to the Ambapali. And they were really upset. How can you sort of receive an invitation from just like a prostitute? No, it doesn't really matter. There's no judgment there. Whoever wishes to invite the monks, we will go. And it's lovely, that's the sense of the monks aren't snobbish. They don't sort of say, I'll only go to rich people's houses, I won't go to poor people's houses. So is prostitution wrong livelihood? That's a tough one. Actually, in the description of wrong livelihoods, I don't think it is listed as wrong livelihood. It certainly was around at the time, like being in an army, trading in arms, trading in liquor, trading in meats, all wrong livelihoods. What other ones were?
Poison.
Trading poisons, yeah, it's wrong livelihood. But they didn't say prostitution at all, it's wrong livelihood. The trouble is these days that a lot of prostitution is actually forced, and it's involved so much crime and sort of drugs and stuff like that, especially in third world countries. And people in prostitution aren't there, you know, from their own free will. They're almost forced into it. It's a terrible situation. And certainly that is certainly wrong livelihood when it's like almost like slavery. Yeah? Trading human beings, but it's your own self. It's a really hard one. Because, again, I'm not an expert on that question. So maybe I'm the wrong person to ask, because, you know, you don't know the ins and outs of the industry, but so, you know, you can sort of say, you can put your foot in your mouth, as I just did. So, I don't really know if it's right livelihood or wrong livelihood. But, at the very least, it's not skillful livelihood, because it's indulging in lust. And just, you know, for money. So there's better ways of making a living than that, for sure. However, I would never put down a person who's a prostitute. I would never say, no, you can't come to our Buddhist society, you can't serve on our committee. Or you can't sort of, I will never go to your house for dharma. I was impressed when I was a young monk, first year in Thailand, I stayed in this city monastery. And I heard that once a year, that they went to one of the brothels in Patpong Road for dharma. The girls there would clean a place up, and they would dress respectfully for the monks. And they do merit making once a year. And the monks weren't sort of snobby enough that they would say, no, we can't go to that place. You know, we can't go to those girls. And they said, well, now everyone needs to make merit, needs to have the opportunity to do good karma. And if they can sort of invite us just to give us a meal for the day, and we do some chanting for them, and give them some loving kindness, why not? And actually that impressed me. I thought that's actually such a wonderful thing, non-judgmental thing to do. So, yeah, that's all I know about it. So, I'll leave that one for the experts. Yeah?
No.
Okay. Has anyone got any comments on that? Do you think it's wrong livelihood? What do you think? Put your hands up if you think it's wrong livelihood.
I
think
there's a lot of criticism
though
for that.
Thailand, yeah. But a lot of that comes actually from the Christians. But I mean, it's prostitutes in the United States, it's on the streets in Australia. Why do they criticise China for that? Every country has prostitutes. I think the worst, certainly you can say when it's like forced, and enslaved, and the girls aren't treated well or whatever, they're abused. That certainly is wrong. We all know that's wrong. But I don't know if it's. I really don't know. What do you think? Just put your hands up if you think it's wrong livelihood. Put your hands up if you think it's right livelihood. You're basically the same as me, you don't know. Yeah? Can you be destined to? You, in the sense that if you've been like a prostitute in your previous life, you have those inclinations. There's an interesting story in one of these books we read. That this was a heart transplant. You know that there's when you have a heart transplant, you wake up, you don't wake up as the owner of the heart, but sometimes you have some memories of the previous owner of the heart. And this man who'd done a lot of heart transplants looked after the patients afterwards. Wrote a story. It's only a fraction of the people have these experiences. But for example, one person, after their heart transplant, was a young girl, and she had all these dreams of, like, very frightening dreams, like nightmares, of being murdered. And when the mother took her to the doctor, you know, the specialist had just given her the operation, he said, well, look, it's a very traumatic operation, having a heart transplant. You know, it's just, you know, it's upset all sorts of stuff in the body. This is just the result of the operation, just trauma. But it kept on happening, and the mother sort of didn't buy that explanation. So she made inquiries, you know, used a few of her contacts to find out who owned the old heart. And they found out, she found out that it was a person who'd been walking in a rough part of town who got murdered. And that made her very interesting. She went to the police. And they interviewed the girl, because she had this nightmare many times. And the situation of the nightmare was so close to the actual, what the police knew about the murder. The police made a detailed interview. And from the details which the child gave, from the dreams, they pieced together the crime, they confronted the culprit, and the culprit confessed. That's actually how they found out who murdered the previous owner of the heart. That's an extra, isn't it? Now this particular story, there was one man, his wife was quite sort of, you know, middle aged, and she had a heart transplant because something wrong with her heart, and they gave her a new heart. And then after she got her new heart, she started becoming very frisky. And so he also wondered, like, where's his personality change come from? And he used his contacts, and the previous heart belonged to a prostitute. And in this book, it's a bit naughty, it says the man was very happy. But good, I'm talking to a lot of people who want to keep 8 precepts. Otherwise, it sort of says your wife. I just don't think about that. But you can actually see that sometimes there's like inclinations. If you've been practicing a certain way for a long time, it becomes inclinations. And so if it was like a rebirth of a prostitute, then probably that would be that, you know, what is in Mark speak called frisky. This is because that's your leanings from the past. The same way if you've been a monk in your past life or nun in your past life, you'd be leaning towards like simplicity. Because that's been your whole life, that's your character. You lean in that direction.
But I feel like it's only a part of the body.
Oh yeah, this is interesting. Well, the heart transplant. Yeah, the thing is, it doesn't last. It's only like, even for those few who have those weird experiences of some connection with the previous owner. I mean, it soon disappears after a few months. You don't have any connection after that. It's interesting, you have some connection. That's only a minor percentage, maybe 3% or something. They have these weird stories that people have, do have some connection with the person around their heart in the past. But then eventually just the rest of their body actually overcomes those tendencies and the woman just becomes like her old self again, loses her friskiness, she loses all those memories. It's fascinating, isn't it? Perhaps. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for that most inspiring talk this morning. It made me realise that I have not been living the Dharma, though I thought that I was following the Noble Eightfold Path. Thank you for your effective, encouraging, sounds so easy, method of the practice into the jhanas. It is easy. It is easy. It is easy. I've got a sort of brainwash here. So again, you describe nimittas as shapes of light with a middle and an edge. This experience of the mind lighting up as if someone has switched all the lights on inside, also a form of nimitta. Or does a nimitta always have a shape with an edge? Thank you, Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu. It's usually when the mind sort of brightens up like that. That's a sign that the mind's getting energy. But you need to have some sort of focus. And so even if it's like the whole light mind's lit up, so as if you're sitting in a brilliant lit room, still there will always be some part of that with the middle of it which has got the best light. That's one we should focus on, especially to get into the jhanas. We're just light all over the place. It's not sort of one pointedness. You've got to somehow find some one peakedness of mind in there. Find a centre of focus, rather than just light all over the place. Richard? Okay. In the recollection of the Sangha, the Blessed One's disciples are referred to as the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. Could you explain what the eight kinds of noble beings are? Okay, those four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, there's the stream winners, once returners, non-returners, and arhats, and those on the path of stream winning, those on the path of once returning, those on the way to being non-returners, and those on the way to being arhats. This is why they have this idea of the path and the fruit. They say that even if you're on the way to doing these things, you're still the noble one. So that's what's called the four pairs. Those on the path to being stream winners and those who are stream winners. And there's actually two people on the path to being stream winners. They call those Sadhanasaris and Dhammanasaris. Those whose faith in the Dhamma is so strong, they haven't reached the stream winning yet. They've got so much faith that when they hear things like non-self and suffering, even though it goes against the grain, their faith is so strong they're going to give it a try, they're going to go in that direction, they're going to find out. They've got great faith in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. Those ones who are like pushed into stream winning through faith. And those other ones, the Dharma and the Sangha, who are pushed into stream winning through wisdom. Their wisdom is so sharp, they see 90% of this. And so they think, well, most of it seems right, that sounds good. They go their next way, the next 10% on the wisdom they have so far. Dhammanusaris and Sadhanusaris. The two types of people on the way to stream winning. And they also say on the path to being a once returner, reaching once returner, on the path to being a non returner, reaching non returning, on the path to being a full arahat, and one who's achieved full arahat. So, like four pairs, eight kinds of people. Those are the noble ones.
So is the attainment of the path as distinct an event as the attainment of the fruit?
No, the attainment of the fruit is a distinct event. That's why it's so very hard to actually know whether you're on the path. But the fruit is the one which is very, very clear. And it's also, this is Ajahn Brahm's ideas. Don't see this in the sutras, you don't see anything in the sutras. It seems that the attainment of anagami, non-returning, is an event, which you can actually pinpoint. The attainment of non-returning, of arahat is obviously an event, but the attainment of once returning, sakadagami, is very hard to pin down at all. That is not an event, that's a process. However, that's Ajahn Brahm says that. In the Abhidharma, they have this really weird idea that the path precedes the fruit only by like a mind moment or two. But however, that's been well disproved by many, many people. I remember Venugunaratna was disproved that a long time ago. So that the path is something which happens and the fruit happens a long time afterwards. It's interesting that those people who are really on the path of stream winning, they say you have to achieve that stream winning in this lifetime if you're on the path. And they, in the commentaries, they give this silly idea that if it's like almost the end of the universe is about to end. Hello? Universe is about to end here. Well, the universe is ending here. If the universe is about to end and you're still not a stream winner yet, the universe has to wait for you. And so the commentary says you're one who holds up the universe. This is this is the one that's on the path of being a stream winner, but hasn't reached it yet. Because of the laws of nature, you have to achieve the fruit of stream winning in that life. So you can't die without it. So if the universe is about to win, I'm sorry, the universe has to wait for you. That's a really interesting idea in the competition. Okay, thank you. Is that okay for that one? Any comments on that? Thank you for your teaching. I'm very touched by your talk about purity of conduct. Did the Buddha ever talk about repentance? I am very sorry about something I have done. How can I make up for it? Thank you. Confess. Confess. No, no, exactly. No, for repentance, it's the idea in Buddhism is like remorse, not guilt. So when anybody did something which was really wrong, hurtful, selfish, they'll go up to the Buddha, even if the monks broke their rules, they go up to the Buddha and they confess what they did, they'd acknowledge it, and all the Buddha would ever say is that, and they'd try and determine to do better next time, and the Buddha said that anyone who acknowledges their faults and tries to do better, that's called growth in Buddhism. That's all he said, and said, off you go. There's no punishment, because you don't need punishment. Punishment actually stops growth. You just end up wallowing in guilt. But what we do is we acknowledge, we forgive, and we learn. That's all we need to do. That's growth in Buddhism. The Buddha made it very clear. And even sometimes people came to murder the Buddha, this group of assassins. When they came to see the Buddha, I mean, that's just really bad karma, thinking you want to kill a Buddha. They came up to him afterwards and they said, look, we just can't do it. No, we're sorry. And that's what the Buddha said. He didn't call the police and have them arrested. He just said, it's acknowledging your fault and trying to do better next time. It's growth in the Dhamma, in the area of discipline. Off you go. And that's actually what we should do for ourselves. If you've made a mistake, done something silly, acknowledge it, learn from it, or just forgive, carry on. But don't hold it. Learn from it. Acknowledging is very important, because sometimes we're so afraid of our faults, we just hide them. We don't really, I didn't do that, it wasn't me. It was like one of my students in prison said, sort of, I don't rob people, I only rob houses. Because like robbing people, like it hurts. Because they can actually see the people they've robbed, and the people they've hurt, and the people they've caused so much trouble to. So he never robbed houses or people, he only robbed houses. Because houses don't hurt, houses don't feel pain. You can see how you're not really acknowledging what you're doing. It's just a way of denial, a way of avoiding the truth. Now, I didn't hurt her, she deserved it. Now, there are all these ways of justifying what we're doing. So you acknowledge the truth of it. Yeah, I did something wrong, I did something selfish, I did something hurtful. Be truthful. Once you're truthful, learn from it and go on. That's all one needs to do for repentance. A lot of times repentance, we go over it again and again and again and again. I should have done this, I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. I'm the worst person in the whole universe, why was I born? If you keep on going on like that, you get so negative, you can't help anybody in this world. You usually, because of your pain, you do more bad karma. So happy people can't have love. Sorry, happy people, unhappy people can't really have love. They can't be kind. So happy people can. They feel free enough to love, to give, to share. So be careful not to dwell in this negativity of guilt and self-punishment. That's not the Buddhist way. Make sense? Okay, next question. I've heard it said that thought is the servant of craving. Please comment. This is last night's question. I was too late putting it in the basket, so I've taken the liberty of asking it today. Sorry if this is a bit cheeky, and thank you. Yeah, you should be very repentant. But make sure you don't do it again. If you acknowledge it and forgive it, it's okay. Thought is the servant of craving. But it's not a very good servant, because that thought goes its own way. It may start with a craving, but sort of the servant runs his own errands after a while. So in a sense it is that once you have that movement of craving and desire, like thought is almost like the vehicle. In the same way that I liken like the thought which goes on in people's minds, like the discussions and debates which go on in the parliaments of countries. Because, you know, we have all these debates and these words which come out, you know, to be able to govern our land, in the same way that thought becomes the government agency of our being. Controller is the thought. And sometimes you've ever listened to, especially Australian Parliament, it sounds just the same as your own thoughts in your own head, doesn't it? If you're honest about it. Always picking faults, shouting at yourself, putting yourself down, just like parliamentarians do in countries like Australia. Never giving the other side a chance. So look at your thoughts, and it is a servant of craving, a servant of delusion as well in that sense. So lack of thought, silence, is a servant of Nibbana, because that will take you to Nibbana, cessation, stillness. Is it okay? Got to go quickly, run out of time. Hi there, can you explain Loka Vidu, knower of the worlds? Yeah. How many worlds are there? Anyone know? I've heard two. Any advance on two? Three. Any advance on three? Three, three, three. Any advance on three? Guys, three. That's correct. The three worlds. The Tiloka. What are those three worlds? What's the first world? Anyone know? Buddhist cosmology is very fascinating. The first world is the realm of human beings, animals, ghosts, hell realms, the deva realms up to the brahma realm. It's called karma loka, the world of the five senses. Because even in the hell realms, they see, they hear, they feel. In the lower deva realms, they also feel, but with the mind-made body, they have five senses. But then you go into the rupa loka, which is based on the jhanas, the four jhanas. And then above that, the last of the three realms is the Arupa Loka, based on the immaterial attainments. Once, the Buddha went to see Baka, the Brahma, God. And as soon as he went up, the Brahma Nimantana Sutta. Sort of the Brahma says, nice you to come here. And the servants of Brahma told the Buddha to worship Brahma. He said, I'm not going to worship him. And they said, you better worship the Brahma, because many other sort of ascetics have managed to develop their psychic powers to come to this place, but they're all inferior to the great Brahma. The Buddha said, no, I'm not inferior. And so the Brahma and the Buddha had a contest. Brahma said, I will disappear from you, Mark, to show just how great I am. But Brahma could not disappear from the Buddha. And then the Buddha said, I'll disappear from you. And then Brahma said, where's he gone? I can't find him. You heard that story? Have you read it? You know what happened? It's the Brahma knows first jhana, but no more than that. So the Brahma went into the first jhana realm. The Buddha followed him there. And then Brahma could not escape. But then the Buddha went into the second jhana realm. Brahma doesn't know that. Where's he gone? Doesn't know more than that. So, the different jhana realms, do you know those realms? There's huge realms made of mind. Those are the three realms. And that's what the Buddha knows. The know not just of, you know, the hell realms, ghost realms, animal realms, human realms, and other deva realms. The realms made of jhana. Pure mind states. Unmoving bliss for eons and eons and eons. It's interesting, those realms are inaccessible from human beings. In the sense that they have these sutras where many of the devas came round to pay respects to the Buddha. But the devas from the Rupa Loka and Arupa Loka never came at all. You know why? Because in jhana you're just completely absorbed. You can't move, you can't go anywhere. If you're in a jhana, someone could talk to you, but you wouldn't be able to listen. They could kick you, you wouldn't feel it. That's how inaccessible the jhanas are. So once you're in those jhana realms, You're there for many eons, immovable, uncontactable. So if you really want to get away from your mobile phone, well, your SMS messages, that's the best place to go. They can't reach you there. Not even Brahma can reach you there. Yeah?
So is that supposed to be like metaphorical, or can you bump into other people in jhana when you're in jhana?
No, when you're in jhana, it's single as a perception.
So what are they talking about? Like the Buddha?
States of existence, worlds. Worlds where you can't be, where you can be.
I mean, the Buddha followed Brahma into jhana. Well, they couldn't know that each other were there.
Yeah, but he did escape from the Buddha, because the Buddha knew that well.
Right.
The second jhana realm was a realm which Brahma didn't even know existed, beyond his perception.
So I don't know if the Buddha entered that realm, was he staying there for eons and eons?
If you entered that realm after you died. But the same way that you can enter jhana right now, but not for eons.
Oh.
The same way you can do that. So they're just entering jhana together. But the Buddha knew second jhana, which was Brahma didn't know. So these are the different worlds which the Buddha knows, which they didn't know.
But then, in the jhana and in samadhi, is different, or?
Well, sometimes they're called samapatti, just mean attainment. It's a Pali word for attainment, which in Thai is samapat. However, that really, it's the way it's used, it's just the attainment of vajana. However, technically, it's only really supposed to be used for the attainment of full cessation, when everything stops. Cessation of all perception, which is sometimes they call the ninth jhana. But just it's used in time for any sort of jhana attainment.
It looks like Rupa is a jhana realm. What is
the immaterial attainments. I'm very careful not to call them immaterial jhanas these days, because we never actually call immaterial jhanas in the text. They're immaterial attainments, so they're based on jhanas. And if you want to know more about those, there's a journal coming up soon. Probably it's actually most printed now. I've written all about jhanas and immaterial attainments there. Coming out soon in a Buddhist society near you. Last question. No, two more questions. When the world comes to an end, does another one start again? Is it then, it's amazing what people think about it. Is it then that all beings that disappeared get reborn into a new world? Please explain. Okay, yeah. When the universe comes to an end, they say the beings for the most part are reborn in those jhana realms. And then after the new world comes, there's new places where people actually can get reborn. So there's opportunities for karma to ripen. So because of that, then the beings disappear from those jhana realms and get reborn into this new world. And because the jhana realms are just so still and peaceful, when they come out from those realms, they don't know where they've been. That's why when the first person to come out, Brahma, thinks he's the firstborn. Can't remember just where he's been. He's been in this bliss state for a long time. Absolute stillness. Comes out, doesn't know. And thinks he's just been the first appeared in the world. They say that's the delusion of God as being the firstborn. Next question. Is. What is your view about the prediction by the Tibetan Buddhist sage Shakyamuni? Shakyamuni was a Buddha, he wasn't Tibetan, he was Indian. Shakyamuni, this was Pamasambhava or something, I think. That the Dharma will be lost from the land of its origin and its seeds cast upon the winds and take root in the land of the iron horses and red faced men, westerners to the Tibetans. We're red faced. Yeah. I suppose Australians have been out in the sun too long. Do the writings and teachings of lay American Buddhists like Stephen Levine and Jack Coulter relate to this idea? Well, not really, I must admit. But there's so many predictions which are made, and if actually go through all the predictions are made, sometimes we wait for things to happen and then we choose the one which fits, or all the other ones that get lost somewhere. So the Dharma will be lost in the land of its origin. It's still in India. There's still monks and nuns in India. Still people practicing Buddhism. And there's still sort of good monasteries out there in India. So it hasn't been lost. It's got weakened over the years. And take root in the land of iron horses and red-faced men. Westerners to Tibetans. It's interesting, but that's actually in some Tibetan texts. It's not done by the Buddha. What the Buddha said was very fascinating. He said that as long as there are arahats in the world, the Dharma will still be strong. That's a lovely saying. As long as there are arahats, enlightened beings in the world, then the Dharma will always be strong in those places. Because they're enlightened beings. You know, it's not so much the words, but the examples, the inspirations. That's what makes Buddhism strong. And that was the Indian sage, Sakyamuni Buddha. Make sense? Okay, so that's it for tonight, folks. I'm sorry, that's all you're getting. We have one more question night tomorrow. But those of you who get enlightened on payday, you'll find you don't need any more questions, because all those questions are answered with the attainment of jhanas, with the attainment of cessation, in the beauty of the mind. There. Where do all questions find their end? In answers or in stillness? So let's answer all the questions by being still. Okay, see you tomorrow.